This is The Doctor Is In, your bi-weekly podcast that discusses all things technical and not so technical. The Doctor Is In podcast is produced by ARRL, the National Association for Amateur Radio, and sponsored by DX Engineering, helping you shrink the globe. See their website at www.dxengineering.com. And now, here's your host, QST editor Steve Ford, WB8IMY, and the doctor himself, Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
I'm Steve Ford, WB8IMY.
I'm Joel Hallis, W1ZR.
Joel, we did a survey not long ago, a QST survey, and I shouldn't have been surprised at this particular result, but I was. And that is that 93% of league members have computers in their ham stations. Now, these are computers either dedicated directly just to amateur radio, or they're doing their household finances on them too, and who knows what else. But with that in mind, I thought if we should talk a little bit about computers in the station. And you probably have at least one, I would think, in your station.
Well, at the moment, I just have one, and it is my main... Well, actually, I have two stations, so it's a little tricky, but my main station, where I do most of my operating, is in my office, and the computer I have there is the same one I do for my taxes and my correspondence and everything else.
I have a feeling that's true of most people.
Yeah, but only because that's also my office. Now, in my older station, which is downstairs, I don't do any of that stuff down there unless something fails upstairs. So, while I can do stuff down there, I don't. I have other kinds of software. But when I had a separate station with its own computer dedicated to ham radio, the general principle was I got the hand-me-down. The oldest computer in the family ended up in, after the dog got his new computer, I got his old computer, and that was the one that went in the shack. So, that worked okay for a while. In fact, my first computer that I had in the station was a IBM PC.
Oh.
Original IBM PC that ran on 2 5-and-a-quarter floppy disks.
What are those?
That computer is actually now in the wireless museum in Windsor. I think it's Windsor, Connecticut.
Are you serious?
Yes, it is. I donated that. And somebody's going to tell me, I would have paid you $5,000 for that. But I doubt it. Anyway, it still works. But it didn't have to do a lot. I mean, the first computer I had in the station just did packet radio. And it was a packet radio terminal display, which was emulating what we used to call a dumb terminal,
yes,
which is not really a computer at all. It's just a display and a keyboard and enough information to be able to translate the key press into an ASCII character and to receive an ASCII character and put it on the screen. This is not heavy-duty computation. In those days, packet radio was run from a separate device called a terminal node controller, and that did all the heavy lifting. That did all the packet assembly and error checking and putting on headers and footers and figuring out the routing and all the other stuff that it had to do. And all the PC had to do was just display the characters that were sent from the controller and take commands or text from the keyboard and send them towards the terminal node controller, which did all the hard work. So that was kind of an extreme on the low computational side. And any computer could do that if it had a serial interface. I mean, it doesn't take much. Nowadays, it's quite a different story. In my station, where I have the computer shared among taxes and bills and everything else, navigation software for the boat and one thing and another, I have multiple things running simultaneously often. And so the computer has to be able to handle the processing for all of those. The biggest one, I think, computationally, is I have a software-defined receiver that actually uses the sound card as the input and output device and does the processing in the computer rather than in the receiver. And that serves as a PAN adapter for me in one corner of the screen. Another corner of the screen has a logging program. Another one has the packet cluster informing me of DX spots. And I have a logging program, which is either a computer logging or a contest logging program or a general purpose one, depending on what I'm doing. And all of these can be running simultaneously along with a few other things. Now, some people have even many more than that. If they run CW Skimmer, which I've never gotten to somehow, or some of these other applications, it not only can fill up the computer, it can overflow the screen. And so you'll find some people actually have multiple monitors with different applications on them. And I could easily see doing that if I had space on my desk. So the real question is, what applications do you need to run and how much horsepower do they need? And most application programs describe at least the amount of memory and amount of disk space they need and so forth. And you can compare that with what your computer has available. So, you know, you have to look at what the total is and what's dedicated to doing your taxes and doing the other things and figure out what's left for this. And
yes.
Chances are you won't be doing the taxes while you're in a contest. At least I've never felt compelled to do that. So it's really a question of what applications you want to run and how much computer horsepower and display capability they need. And you kind of get a match for that.
Yes. I mean, if you look at WSGTX.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
Which runs FT8, which is extremely popular
yes,
these days.
Yes,
but I've successfully used WSGTX with FT8 with computers that had, roughly 1.5 gigahertz in terms of the processor clock speed and memory on the range of, say, 4 gigabits. I would say, of RAM, and it works just fine. In fact, in a recent Eclectic Technology column, I mentioned that I had had difficulty with the Raspberry Pi microcomputer running WSJTX. Well, as it turns out, there is now the Raspberry Pi 3B and the B Plus, which are considerably more powerful, and they will run WSJTX successfully. So, I mean, for our discussion here, we're talking about desktop or laptop computers. But as you can imagine, the variety, if you're looking at computers like the Raspberry Pi all the way up to a what they call a gaming desktop, which is quite powerful, you could be looking at a large variety of machines. But for most ham applications, a laptop or a desktop seems to be fine.
Yeah, absolutely. And you say most applications, and I guess where people get in trouble is it'll work on this application, it'll work on that application, it'll work on the other application. But when you try to work all of them at the same time, then you can get in trouble. And that's really the issue. And that's a little hard to determine because they don't all, even though they're all running, they're not all dealing with data at the same time. So sometimes every now and then they all run into each other and things stop happening. So it really comes down to how much you're trying to do, and you just keep doing it until it doesn't work anymore and you take one of the applications off. Or you get the next, say to your wife, wouldn't she like to have a new computer, and you take her old computer and that becomes your new station computer.
Well, now what operating system are you running on your station computer?
My main station computer is running Windows 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess my other computer actually is on loan. It's actually being used as a Major League Baseball internet receiver and translator for my wife to be able to watch the Red Sox on TV. But the season's almost over as we're recording this. It actually is, the regular season's over, so I should get it back in a few weeks.
That's a unique application.
Well, yeah. But since I don't spend that much time on the downstairs station anymore, it's not a problem. And if I needed it, I could take it down there. It's a laptop, so it works. And, you know, we go on a trip, I unplug it from that, and I take it with me. So,
yeah. Well, as part of the computer survey that we ran, that I mentioned at the beginning of the podcast, we asked what sort of operating system most hams were using. The vast majority were running Windows. Not necessarily Windows 10, although I run Windows 10. Some were running even Windows XP, which surprised me.
Well, I have a system that does that. It's sort of a backup system at the moment, but it has all my, you know, I can survive on that if I have to.
Now, of course, there's also Linux. That was in the single digits percentage-wise, but even though that number of hams that are using Linux is quite small, it's a very enthusiastic group.
Absolutely.
And they're doing all sorts of interesting experimental things. And then, of course, there are the Mac users as well. They outnumbered the Linux users in our survey. They were still, though, right around 10 to 15%, something on that.
Yeah, they're significant. And it surprises me a little bit. This is something that came up in a related conversation with somebody who was responding to a product review I just did on a very nice HF transceiver. And he said, I was really interested in this until I got to the place where it said you could only talk to it with a Windows computer. He says, I've crossed that off my list. And I was saying, boy, what a shame, because the Windows processing is nothing to do with the operating of that exactly. It's mainly needed for downloading software and a few other kinds of things. I guess if you want to do logging using the data from the computer, you need to have Windows to do that. And I was thinking to myself, boy, if it were me, rather than saying, well, I use a Mac, so I'm not going to consider that transceiver, I would think computers are almost inexpensive enough now that you could get a small Windows computer that could deal with that and do all that stuff. And then you have the transceiver that you want and do all the rest of your stuff on your Mac. It just seems to me that you're kind of shortchanging yourself if you limit yourself to a particular kind of computers.
Well, you make an excellent point. I'm seeing Windows laptops, basic laptops, and little netbooks going for $200 or $300.
Yeah. And that's less than 10% of the cost of this transceiver, for example. Yeah. And you can do it, use it for other things, too. So, you know, I think it's important to be flexible, I guess is what I'm trying to say.
Well, there was a time when not many hams had the internet available in their stations as well. And that was something else that was really interesting that came up in the survey. I guess I shouldn't be surprised, but most amateurs now have broadband connections in their stations. Not necessarily ultra-high-speed broadband, usually on the order of, 1-2 megabits per second download speed in their stations. Although that's adequate for many applications, but they're using it to upload to Logbook of the World and to spot DX on clusters and so on and so forth. I assume you have that as well.
I do, and actually I was kind of surprised. It's an interesting segue a little bit, but I have cable-provided internet. I have a network in the house, an Ethernet, wired Ethernet with outlets, you know, 6 in our office, and almost every room has an outlet. I was surprised to find that I can get up to 50 megabits per second out of my connection, and then...
Really?
I had an issue that came up in another product review where I actually had to provide, my thing is based on 10 base 3, which is supposed to go 10 megabits per second. Okay, that's where we're starting from. This had to have a Cat 6 connection instead of my Cat 10 base T connection. And I actually got a Cat 6 cable and ran it to my internet router that I use in the basement. And lo and behold, with those 8-wire kind of double connection arrangements in the Cat 6, I was actually getting 100 megabits per second to Boston and to New York City on the internet. So I'm thinking, oh, I guess it's getting to be time to rewire the house pretty soon. Although I'm not sure why I would ever need that. I guess for three-dimensional large screen movies someday,
yes.
Might make a difference.
I've always been jealous of the hams, and I imagine some of them are listeners to this podcast that are blessed with fiber optic to their home, and they're seeing extraordinary speeds. I don't know what ham applications you need that kind of speed for, but just for everything else, it's amazing.
Well, it's one of those things. When the speeds get out there, then people will start providing applications that require the speeds. It's the old thing between the computer people and the software people. So when the network people come up with gigabit speeds, the information providers will come up with information that requires those speeds. So I'm thinking a little bit ahead and thinking that, you know, maybe it's time to
It always helps to keep up because you know that people like Joe Taylor – and others are going to be developing more and more and more advanced software that will require more computer horsepower to run it.
Yep.
Not today, not tomorrow, but one of these days, definitely.
Fortunately, I'm old enough, I may not have to see that many more these days, but I'm hatching plots on how to easily upgrade my system. I think I can do it.
Well, why don't we take a break, Joel? We'll hear from DX Engineering, and we will be back.
Every ham radio operator knows speed matters. Whether it's jumping in your truck during an emergency or staying up all night for lightning-quick contesting, seconds count. And there's nothing more painful than being off the air waiting for equipment to arrive. At DX Engineering, we know a thing or two about speed. You can count on us to provide the fastest shipping in the ham universe. How fast? You get same-day shipping on most orders placed by 10 p.m. Eastern Time. It's that fast. So that new rig, antenna, cable assembly, or replacement part you need will make it to your shack in plenty of time to work a remote DXCC entity or dominate the competition in the next contest. And the best part is DX Engineering offers free shipping for most orders over $99. Radio waves travel at the speed of light. Lucky for you, so does DX Engineering. Visit DXEngineering.com. That's DXEngineering.com.
And we're back, Joel, and I have a question from Gary, AB7VK, and he's asking, squelch. No, he has more to say. What is it? Why do radios have adjustments for squelch? I hear the term used, such as the squelch opened. What does that term mean? What is the intended purpose of squelch? I always thought the word was strange, even from my earliest days in ham radio, but anyway.
Well, the term goes back, like most radio things, to before ham radio. Squelch is a function that was first widely popular, and to my knowledge, in VHF FM systems that were used by commercial mobile units, public service, police, fire, power companies, that sort of thing, utility trucks. And basically what it does is when there's no signal present, it turns off the audio coming out of the receiver. The reason for this is very simple. If you have a guy sitting in a truck and you don't have this function, when there's nobody talking on the radio, there's a very loud hissing noise that comes out of an FM radio that is very annoying.
That will quickly drive you insane.
So rather than going insane, what the truck driver will do will be turn the volume all the way down.
Yes.
So he doesn't hear anybody calling him.
Like his dispatcher.
Yeah, exactly. So therefore, it not only gets rid of the noise, but he doesn't have that much he has to do that day. So they added squelch, which effectively does that electronically, so that if the squelch is open, the radio is on and you're hearing something come through, and it can be the noise that would be there, or it can be somebody talking. Now, what you have is a squelch control. So when nobody's talking, you turn the squelch down until it gets quiet. The squelch closes and you hear nothing. And then when somebody talks, the squelch opens and you hear them. So it solves this problem. There's some related problems, by the way, if it's not used properly. If you turn it too far, it can be that you have to be a very strong signal to be able to open it. Many people make that mistake. You say, oh, I turned it down so I got rid of the noise. Well, if you turn it down too far, you get rid of the signals as well. And it's just like turning the volume all the way down. But if you set it right beyond that threshold where it just gets quiet, anytime somebody's on the channel, you'll hear them. And when nobody's on the channel, you won't hear anything because the squelch will be closed. And it's called, the squelch is opened when there's a signal present. Now, it's a little tricky because it's hard for the receiver sometimes to tell the difference between the noise and a signal. Some kinds of noise can trigger the squelch, and you may have to readjust the setting. You go through areas with a lot of signals around or interference. So you have to kind of keep your eye or your fingers on that control to make sure you're setting it to be most sensitive, but it usually works very well. It just basically, the way it works is the squelch looks at the automatic gain control voltage, which keeps the audio from getting too loud in general, but that's measured before the squelch control, so that if the AGC indicates a signal present, it opens it. If the AGC indicates that there is no signal present, it closes. And what happened was that this very equipment, this FM, VHF FM equipment that all these trucks and police departments used in, I have to think about, I was working in the business at the time, like in maybe the early 1960s. There was some grace period of some years. The FCC decided that they had to make the FM channels half as wide so they could have twice as many people using them because the demand went up. And all of the radios that had been in use up until then had to be either modified to be narrow band or disposed of and replaced. It was possible to modify them. To modify the transmit, you just had to turn the modulation control down. On the receiver, you generally had to get a different IF filter, so you just hear the one narrower channel. And we actually did upgrade some radios. But I think most people just said, oh, well, we've had this radio for a long time. Let's just chuck this one and get a new one. They're smaller, lighter, and work better. And so there were piles of these radios around that nobody wanted. And hams, of course, snapped them up. They were designed for the 30 to 50 megahertz public service band, or the 150 to 170 or so megahertz band. So the one kind was fairly easily modifiable to 6 meters, the other to 2 meters, and that's what hams did. So the early ham FM gear was the old commercial gear on a different frequency, and all the same controls were there, including the squelch, and that's where I believe it came from.
Well, that makes sense. And, of course, squelch, the word squelch, has been applied to some other functions as well, like the tone-coded squelch, is a type of squelch, I mean, functionally similar in that it basically cuts the audio, but in this case, the trigger is a tone of a certain frequency.
That's right.
That will open the audio and then allow you to hear it. And of course, CTCSS, a very similar concept.
Yep, that's used for most, to get into most repeaters, you need to have the right frequency just so that you can have multiple repeaters in the area and you won't get into all of them. You'll just get into the one that you intend to get into, which makes life a lot easier for everybody else.
But basically, the function is the same. In other words, keeping everything quiet until there is a signal on the frequency. period.
Yeah, and in that case, in the case of the CTCSS, it's until somebody has a signal on the frequency that's one that you want to hear.
Yes, with the proper tone. Yeah. I've seen on some VHF, UHF transceivers, both mobile and handheld, they will allow you to select a squelch that is either based on the actual strength of the signal, which is standards, what we've been talking about. But there is also what they call S-meter squelch, which in other words, you would think that would be about the same, but I guess it's tapping into the indications on the S-meter rather than signal strength. Why would they do that?
I have no idea. It seems like that's exactly what, I guess you could be more specific. Rather than just tuning it till the squelch opens or closes with this knob, you can say, well, I just want to listen to, if he's not somebody up to S7, I don't want to talk to him because it's not going
right,
to be accurate. So that,
right.
That's kind of a consistent level, whereas the other one is kind of a, you know, seat of the pants kind of thing.
That could be.
I've never actually seen that. That's interesting.
Yeah, and I don't see it frequently, but I have on occasion. All right, Joel, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
If you have a question for the doctor, email us at doctor@arrl.org. The Doctor Is In podcast is sponsored by DX Engineering at www.dxengineering.com. Background music provided by Purple Planet at www.purple-planet.com. This podcast is copyright ARRL. All rights are reserved. Until next time, I'm QST Managing Editor Becky Schoenfeld, W1BXY 73, and thanks for listening.